Shemai Croeso, hello and welcome to the latest episode of the CC4 Museum of Welsh Cricket Podcasts. On Glamorgan's recent visit to the home of cricket at Lord's, I managed to spend a little bit of time with our guest on this week's episode, Neil Robinson. Neil is the head of heritage and collections at the MCC Museum. We met in the library and we started by talking about his early days.
Neil, very warm welcome to the CC4 Museum of Welsh Cricket Podcast. It's lovely to meet you.
Thank you.
One of the things I discovered this morning on the coach trip up from Wales was that you were born in the same place as a very auspicious ex-Glamorgan captain, Ozzie Wheatley. Were you born in Gateshead?
I was, yes.
All right. Can you tell us a little bit about your early life and perhaps falling in love with cricket?
Yes, by all means. I didn't spend very long in Gateshead. I was born in a maternity ward there, but my parents lived just west of Gateshead in a little commuter town called Wickham. But I spent most of my childhood north of the River Tyne in Newcastle, where, of course, it's a hotbed of football. So football was the number one sport at school and at home when I was growing up. But cricket sort of ticked along in the background. My dad used to watch the test matches on TV and John Player League matches on Sunday afternoons. And I remember the first time I went to a cricket match would have been when we were on holiday in Bournemouth in 1974, when my mother took me to see the cricket at Dean Park. And she later told me, I have no recollection of this, that it was Hampshire v Somerset, and I got to see a young Ian Botham bowling at Trevor Jesty. Sadly, we missed Barry Richards on that day. So cricket was always there, but it was never a priority for me. Football was the number one sport. And then came 1981 and Botham's Ashes. And my recollection of the sort of light bulb moment that stimulated my love for the game is not Botham bashing the ball to all corners of Headingley, but Bob Willis steaming down the hill on the final day and bowling the Australians out while seemingly in a trance. That captivated me, and I remember we went on holiday. I missed most of the rest of the series because we went on holiday to Yugoslavia for some reason. And while we were there, I was painstakingly copying out the county scores from the English newspapers that we got. So suddenly this background interest had blossomed into something far more important to me. And from that point on, I spent most summer days, you know, throwing a cricket ball around the back garden. Luckily enough, at the same time, a kid moved up to my school from Barnsley who was a big Yorkshire fan, a big cricket fan. So I played a lot of cricket with him. And from that point on, it just grew. I was never a great player, played a bit of office cricket, but I was never good enough to make my university side. So it was really through following the game as a spectator, mostly on television, because we didn't have first-class cricket in the Northeast in those days, and through reading books that I maintained my love of the game.
Did you have any county allegiances then?
I suppose, like a lot of people in the Northeast, the closest ground to us was Headingley for first-class cricket. And if anyone wanted to go and see a day's test cricket from Newcastle, they'd get the train down to Leeds. So, like a lot of people, I supported Yorkshire. By the time Durham became a first-class county in 1992, I'd left the region. I'd gone off to university, and a year later I was working in London. So I never really had a chance to experience Durham as a first-class county. Although I was actually here at Lord's when they beat Middlesex in a county championship game for the first time in 1998. That was the first time I saw them play here, and it was a fantastic experience.
I think I've got your current title correct. You're Head of Heritage and Collections.
That's right.
At the MCC Museum.
Mm-hmm.
How does someone from the Northeast end up as the Head of Heritage and Collections at the MCC?
Well, I need to tell you a little bit of career background to start this story. It really goes back to my first job, which was in the Home Office. So I spent 6 years in the Home Office after I left university and hated it. So I quit that just before I turned 30 and did a bit of travelling, and eventually worked out that being a librarian would be a nice thing to do. A job where you get to help people, where you get to be surrounded by books. So I signed up on a library course at Robert Gordon University in Aberdeen, and as part of that one-year course, we had to do a one-month work placement. And the placement office gave us a little form to fill in with five blank spots on, where you could suggest libraries or information services anywhere in the UK or Ireland that you might want to work at. I thought I could afford to throw away one on an impossible dream. So top of the list went MCC Library, Lord's Cricket Ground. I forget what the other four are. It became irrelevant. And I was just very lucky that when that form went out, my predecessor now, Adam Chadwick, had just taken over as what was then the role of curator of collections in charge of the museum, library and archive. And he came from a fine arts background at Christie's, the auctioneer. He wasn't really a book man, but he knew that the library here was a sort of underappreciated gem, that it had potential that hadn't yet been realised. So he was more than happy to have a keen library student along to try and identify some problems with the library, to try and identify what that potential might be and where it could go. So I spent 4 weeks down here in the summer of 2004. And I remember my first day, we had a meeting in the committee room of what was a group called the Publishing Working Party. And I sat there on this long wooden table facing these big plate glass windows looking out over the outfield on a nice spring morning. And I was sat next to Jonathan Rice, cricket writer. I was sat opposite David Raven-Allen, cricket writer. There was Graham Wright in the room, who had been Wisden editor fairly recently. And I looked around and thought, I could get used to this. But I only had a month to enjoy it. But luckily, I must have made some impression, because when I went away, completed my course, did a couple of years in public libraries in Northamptonshire. But I kept in touch with Adam and Glenys, his assistant. And eventually, when the opportunity for a permanent role here came up, they were on the phone to me. And I guess I was the only interviewee at the time, and as long as I satisfied them that I could do the job, I was in the door, and I wasn't letting anyone else through behind me. So that's how it started. I started as the departmental junior 18 years ago in 2006, and gradually I've acquired more seniority until when Adam passed his new at Wimbledon in 2019. I was promoted into his role, and that's how I came to be here. I suppose it's a combination of enthusiasm for cricket, bit of background historical knowledge of the game, luck and good timing.
Can you tell us a little bit of, I know this is probably opening up to a long answer, but a little bit about the history of the museum? I know it's not as old as the ground, is it?
No, it's not. In fact, the collection itself is not as old as the ground. We're a little unlucky in that we probably have one of the oldest sporting collections in the world, but we're not the oldest sporting museum in the world. Sadly, the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York, beat us to that by a couple of decades, I think. The museum opened in 1953, but the club started collecting in the 1860s when the departing leaseholder of the ground, James Dark, gifted the club a couple of paintings when he left Lord's. And that inspired the club's then committee member and treasurer, Sir Spencer Ponsonby Fain, to begin a collection of artworks to decorate the pavilion. That's how the collection, the museum collection, started. The library collection, we date really from the 1890s. About 1893, we started actively accepting donations of books to build a cricket library. And I think the timing's indicative that in 1890, we opened this magnificent new pavilion, which meant that the club's members at last had a clubhouse to match any of the great gentlemen's clubs in the West End of London. So any great gentlemen's club would have a library for its members. That's an indicative bit of timing for me. But we didn't have a publicly available. All of that was for members. When the Ashes Urn was donated to the club in 1928... we had nowhere public to display it. It went on display in the long room in the pavilion, so members could see it, players could see it as they passed through, staff could see it, but there was nowhere to publicly display it until after the Second World War. During the war, there was discussion about what to do with a disused rackets court in the particular block we're sitting in now, sitting in the MCC library above what's now the museum. And prior to that, all of this building had been set up for racket sports. It was built in 1900, directly behind the pavilion. Its main focus is the real tennis court. There are also a couple of squash courts. What was then the rackets court in 1900 became the MCC Museum, initially the Imperial Memorial Cricket Gallery, in 1953, and was opened by the Duke of Edinburgh at a ceremony attended by the Bishop of London. And that was really the first time that we had an opportunity to display our collection of artefacts and artworks to the general public. And our first curator, Diana Raitt Carr, who was a remarkable woman, she got the job essentially because she was the club secretary's daughter. But, as I say, she was a remarkable and very determined woman. And she wrote off to people like Dennis Compton, asking for donations of memorabilia, donations of kit that she could decorate this museum with. She wrote off to clubs and associations around the Empire and Commonwealth, as it was then becoming, for paintings of cricket grounds so that we could reflect the global spread of the game. And a lot of those paintings are on display in the pavilion still today. So she really built the collection from its foundations into something that could really help to educate the public about the global spread of the game and about MCC's role in that.
So you've been here 18 years?
18 years, yeah.
Can you give us an idea of what's changed in the museum in the time that you've been here and what's happened to the collections and how you've developed them and made them more available to people?
It's been a radical period of change, and I think a lot of the credit for that has to go to Adam, my predecessor. He hired me because he wanted a professional staff, and everybody who's been hired subsequently has either been a professional librarian like myself, or a professional archivist, or a museum professional, all with the relevant qualifications for what we do. But the main thing we didn't have when I joined in 2006 was we didn't have a professional cataloguing platform. We had an access database for the library books, but all we had for the museum was a series of old catalogue cards dating back to Diana's time, and she retired in the 1960s, that might have had a few update notes scribbled on them, but that was it. So we really didn't know what we had. We didn't have an archive store at all until that was actually built the same year I joined in 2006. So the club's institutional memory, all that paperwork going back to its early years, was stored in boxes in various offices, attics, cupboards, void spaces in under the roof of stands, not all of it really in very good conditions. So one of the first jobs was to actually get all of that material into a controlled space, which was climate controlled, which we could keep clean, make sure everything that went in there was clean, was stored in proper archival standard acid-free folders and boxes, and then start to create a basic inventory. So we spent a lot of time creating an inventory of the archive, which allowed us to establish what to start cataloguing in detail. And then we hired a team of what we thought was going to be temporary cataloguing staff. In the end, luckily, many of them managed to stay on in the longer term. But it was a huge process, and Robert Kerfey particularly, and also his colleague Alan Rees, pretty much catalogued the archive from scratch. And it was no less a job in the library either, because the access database told us the titles we had, but we had no idea how many copies of each title we had, and any provenance information on that database couldn't necessarily be linked to a particular copy of a book unless there was an inscription that made it obvious. So there was an awful lot of work to do. The library was pretty much done by the time of the bicentenary, and we were able to get the library catalogue online 10 years ago, which had a huge impact on the number of visits we have in the library. The museum is very much still an ongoing story. Everything's catalogued now, but there's cataloguing and there's cataloguing. We have far too many records which are basically a description of what the item is, but no real context to it, no real idea of what stories it could tell, and in some cases no real idea of why we have it at all or where it came from. So there's still a lot more work to do, and I think if you go to any museum in the world, you'll probably find that cataloguing is something that you can never say is complete, because there's always more information to add. So that's probably been the principal change in my time here.
I guess in terms of an audience, the most obvious place that people see is the museum itself. Can you give us a bit of a virtual tour of that? What do people experience when they come to the museum for the first time?
There are four distinct spaces you can see in the museum. The first, as you come in, is what we call our main permanent gallery on the ground floor. And that's where we keep, notionally, our permanent collection, our permanent exhibition. We tend to change displays there roughly once every 10 years. At the moment, we've got a display based on Cricketers of the Year, largely Wisden Cricketers of the Year, but it does go a little back bit before. And we're replacing that at the end of this season with a new display looking at specific objects that can tell stories from landmark moments in cricket, so a history of cricket in 50 objects, if you will. That space is always viewed as a sort of introductory overview to the game, and then the other spaces within the museum are more for specific themed exhibitions, and they'll tend to rotate a little bit more quickly. So the back room on the ground floor is now our new community gallery, which opened last year, which is a dedicated space for individual communities to come in and tell their own stories in their own words, often using their own artifacts, but just with our expertise and our facilities to help them tell that story. So that's a new innovation we're quite proud of, and we'll probably change displays there every couple of years. On the upper floor, we've got our main temporary display area, which is currently occupied by an exhibition called No Foreign Field, which tracks the sort of parallels between the spread of cricket and the governance of cricket and the spread of the British Empire, which is a very interesting parallel to dive into. That occupies the main space upstairs, and there's also a little corner gallery where we used to keep the Ashes Urn at one point, which is suitable for relatively small-scale displays. Often we have a lot of wall vinyls with timelines telling a particular history up there. At the moment, we've got a photographic display from the photographer Tom Shaw, who set out to record the stories of all of the black Caribbean cricketers who played cricket for England, both male and female, Test and ODI. And again, that's a space that we'd probably rotate every couple of years, although we're a little less fixed on that little corner space because it's not quite such a significant area. And we tend to update it when we have another good idea that comes along.
Quite interesting listening to you describe some of the exhibitions that you've got currently and how they key into maybe some of the debates that are in cricket at the moment about the equality of the game and the importance of the range of people that play it. Has that been a significant change in the sense that the museum has had to take into account these debates that are going on about the game of cricket and its place in society?
I think it's probably been less of a sudden revolution as a more long-term evolution for us. I think we noticed, going back more than a decade, that the demographics of people who visit Lords on the Lords Tour were very interesting, in that about a third of them, and we had at times 70,000, 80,000 people a year coming through on the Lords Tour. It's a very popular tourist destination. About a third of them were from the Indian subcontinent, mainly from India, but others from Pakistan and Bangladesh and Sri Lanka as well. And that made us really think about what we were presenting that audience with. And every Lord's Tour at that time began with the story of the Ashes Urn, the most famous object in the museum, which was fine for an Anglo-Australian traditional audience, but wasn't really serving the Indian audience, which was perhaps more interested in the Indian experience. And the other element of that, particularly for me, is that we call ourselves the home of cricket. And if you really want that phrase to mean anything, you have to be the home of cricket for every cricket fan, wherever they come from in the world, whatever their background. When they come here, perhaps for the only time in their lives, they need to feel that their cricketing culture, their country's cricket heritage, their community's cricket heritage is celebrated as much as anybody else's. And you can't simply do that by telling the story of the Ashes, the story of Anglo-Australian cricket, or the story of Lords and MCC. We have to be essentially a world cricket museum without necessarily using the name. So over that decade or so, we set about broadening the scope of the collection to include more portraits of overseas cricketers, more portraits of women cricketers, which is still a work in progress, and more items relating to cricket around the world. We ran a couple of exhibitions, one on the history of South African cricket, one on the history of Pakistan cricket, which Peter Oborne helped us with. And they were in part a way for us to examine what we had, what we didn't have, and also to encourage people to come forward to us and say, well, if you're a bit lacking in this area of your collection, maybe I can help you out. Here's a donation of material, or maybe you'd like to buy something from us. So we've tried to grow the scope of the collection in that way. And then during COVID, we had an opportunity to actually assess how far we'd gone with that and what the next step needed to be. And this is where ideas like the community gallery came from. I'd had an approach from two Jewish members before COVID, who wanted a fairly small-scale exhibition about Jewish cricket and cricketers in the MCC Museum. And I liked the idea, but I hadn't really got very far with it. But then over the period of COVID, we were furloughed. We had nothing to do but think. So we had the opportunity to take an idea like this and think about, you know, how we could communicate better with audiences who were interested in this kind of material. And the obvious way to do that is to actually work with someone who understands the perspective of that community. So I actually worked with Zaki and Daniel. I put the idea of the community gallery together, and I invited Zaki and Daniel, these two Jewish members, to come in and tell their story in their own words, and we just helped them tell it. And in a similar way with the Cricket and Empire exhibition, No Foreign Field, on the upper floor, I worked with an Indian academic based at the University of Leicester called Prashant Kadambi, who's also a damn good cricket author. We thrashed the idea out together. We thrashed the themes out together. He wrote 50% of the text. I wrote 50% of the text. We ran it by the South African historian, Andre Odendaal. We ran it by the women's cricket historian, Raf Nicholson. So there was a broader view of what this exhibition should include, what stories it should tell, and how those stories should be communicated to a global audience. What I really wanted to get out of that was that we didn't simply tell stories of world cricket from an MCC or Anglo-centric perspective. Not because we were trying to tick a diversity box, but because actually if you tell history from a broader set of perspectives, it's better history. And that's really where we were. We were in the process of developing these ideas when Black Lives Matter, when all that blew up in 2020, and subsequently the ICEC report came out. You know, we just opened the community gallery and that exhibition in the weeks leading up to that report being released. So it wasn't so much a sense of, well, job done, we're way ahead of you, but it was almost like a kind of validation of the direction of travel we'd been on for a number of years by that stage. And I do like to think that when people come into the ground now, they get a sense that it's not just about Lords, it's not just about MCC, it's about what a global game cricket is and how differently it's experienced around the world, and how you can still manage to touch those experiences through the collection here at Lords.
You've mentioned the Ashes Urn, and it's a story that probably most people know some part of. Perhaps you might want to retell that story for us and give a little bit of detail. But I wanted to ask you what, in your view, are the gems of the collection, the highlights or the standout artefacts?
I think before I run away with the Ashes Urn, which might take some time, I'd probably better mention some of the other gems. And I mentioned how the Indian audiences connect sometimes with different objects and experiences here at Lords. And I think the key one for them is the Prudential Trophy, the very first men's World Cup from 1975 to 1983, the first three finals held here at Lords. And of course, India famously won that 83 final against the previously dominant West Indies team when everybody was expecting the West Indies to walk it. That for me is a really important artefact, not simply because the Indians love it, because they won here at Lords, they won an international cricket tournament for the first time, but because of how that moment in cricket actually changed the game. Prior to that, India didn't really seem to have a great deal of interest in one-day cricket. They hadn't played that many games outside of one-day competition, outside of World Cup competitions. And the focus was very much on Test cricket, on the Ranji Trophy, the Dilip Trophy over there. And yet suddenly from that point, you see the passion for one-day cricket, for limited overs cricket generally, begin to take off in India. And that journey really starts, which ends with the IPL and the dominance of India in world cricket today, particularly in how one-day cricket seems to overshadow the first-class and test game, particularly in that part of the world. So I think it's such a pivotal moment for cricket, and the artefact that highlights that moment in our collection is the Prudential Trophy. I definitely put that down as one of the great objects in our collection. I think some of our early artworks are fantastic as well, and you can actually see in some of the 18th century portraiture that we have, not that these are portraits of famous cricketers by any means, they're often children, but it shows how suddenly from in the 17th century, cricket having been a very disreputable game and all of the references in print to it being about people being sent into court for playing cricket on Sunday when they should have been at church, suddenly it becomes a popular game with the aristocracy. And the children of the aristocracy are being painted, as they always were, with the implements of their pastimes and hobbies. And it starts being cricket bats and cricket balls and wickets. So you can see this sudden social shift in the prestige of the game happening through the portraiture in the collection. That's very important for me. As well as there being fine works of art by people like Jacques Sablé and Nathaniel Dance, and Francis Coates, all of whom people in the art world will know better than people in the cricket world know, but they're fantastic artworks that happen to pinpoint a moment of great historical importance in cricket. I think one of my other favourite objects is probably it's a copy of Wisden that was owned by the cricket writer and broadcaster Jim Swanton, 1939 edition, that he had with him when he was taken into captivity by the Japanese army in Singapore in 1942. And he kept it with him throughout his captivity on the Burma Railway. And it effectively became the backbone of the camp library, and it was loaned out to fellow inmates for a limited number of hours at a time. And during those hours where they had that book in their possession, they were able to open it and re-enter a world that must have seemed completely lost to them. The summer of 1938, when Bradman's Australians were touring England, when county cricket was still untroubled by the war that was about to break out, when they could still read about overseas cricket, schools cricket. Maybe some of them had children, sons who were mentioned in the schools cricket section. They got to read about their exploits. Maybe the only time they got to read their names during that time. It's just, it's so indicative of how cricket can allow people to escape the horrors of present-day existence, and for those particular men, their present-day existence was particularly horrible. So that's one of my favourite artefacts. There are so many I could talk about, but I will move on to the Ashes Urn now, because that's the one everyone knows. One of the things I always like to stress when I'm talking about the Ashes Urn is the mystery. We know how big it is, we know how much it weighs, we know what it means, but we don't really know where it came from. We don't know with absolute certainty what's in it. We could probably take the cork out and examine what's in it and lay to rest some of the more outlandish theories that have been out there over the years. But that would destroy the mystery, and the mystery adds so much to the legend of the artifact that I think we'd rather keep it there. So when I tell you the story of the Ashes Urn, it really is what we think here at Lord's is the most likely story. The background to it comes from the test match at the Oval in 1882, which was only the second test match ever played in this country, in which Australia defeated England on English soil for the first time. Now, this is supposed to be some great national disaster, but as I say, it's the second test match that's ever taken place. So England had only won one before, and most of the test matches that had taken place in Australia had been won by Australia. And actually, Australia had beaten on their 1878 tour a very good MCC side here at Lord's in one day in a four innings match. So it really shouldn't have been a great shock, and actually the Australian team were cheered all the way home by jubilant crowds. The crowd reaction was actually very positive to the thrilling game of cricket they'd seen, but the press reaction was a little bit different. And a few days after the game, a spoof obituary appeared in the Sporting Times declaring the death of English cricket and that the body would be cremated and the ashes taken to Australia, which was a nod to the fact that there was a big debate around legalising cremation in the UK at the time. It was still an illegal practice. But it was taken in the cricketing world as a joke rather than a political statement, and an England team was going out to Australia that following winter under the captaincy of the Honourable Ivo Bligh. He declared that he was going out to regain the ashes of English cricket, by which he simply meant the honour of English cricket. There were no ashes at the time. The Australian captain, Billy Murdoch, said he would defend the Ashes on behalf of Australia, and so the scene was set for the first ever Ashes series. Three test matches were scheduled for the new year, but before the first of them even took place, the England amateurs, not the professionals, it's important to note, the social divide did not permit the professionals to take advantage of the invitation, The amateurs, led by Ivo, were invited to spend Christmas at Rupert's Wood House outside Sunbury in Victoria, which was the home of Sir William and Lady Janet Clark, who were Sir William being the president of the Melbourne Cricket Club, the equivalent MCC in Australia. And it was his duty, as the leading man in the area, to host these distinguished visitors from the mother country. There was a diplomatic function on both sides as well. On Christmas Eve, a social match was played between Ivo's amateurs and some estate workers and local cricketers, which Ivo's team naturally won. Lady Janet Clark thought that by this Ivo had regained the honour of English cricket and should therefore be rewarded with the ashes he'd come out to reclaim. So we believe what happened next is that she went upstairs to her dressing room, took what was probably a little pottery memento that she'd picked up on holiday in Europe. We know the family had visited Europe in 1882, just a few months earlier. She may have been using it as a perfume jar or an ointment jar of some description. It may have not been used for anything at all. We now believe that a bale that was used on the wickets in that match was burnt. The ashes of the bale were placed in the urn and were presented to Ivo as the ashes of English cricket. Ivo then goes off to play with his team those three test matches. England win the series 2-1. After the final match at Sydney, a little excerpt from a poem in Melbourne Punch is pasted over the front of the urn. It may be that more ashes were added to the to the urn at this stage. We certainly know that one of the bales that was used in that Sydney match was converted into a letter opener and is still in the possession of the Clark family, now by marriage the Metherall family, in Australia. So that's perfectly possible too. We simply don't know. What we do know is that at the end of the tour, when Ivo was addressing the farewell dinner at the Melbourne Cricket Club, he said the ashes should be buried in a corner of the Melbourne cricket ground and forgotten. He didn't mean the urn. He took the urn home with him. He meant the idea of the ashes as some kind of conflict between England and Australia. The urn had a rather different meaning for him, because at that presentation, the Clark family governess, Florence Rose Morphy, had been present. And over the course of the tour, Ivo and Florence fell in love. And a year later, he would come back to Australia, having secured his father's permission, his father being the Earl of Darnley. And he would marry Florence and eventually take her back to England, where they lived their life together. So for Ivo and Florence, this little pottery urn really had not so much to do with cricket as it was a memento of their early romance, their early courtship. And it was only after the idea of the ashes was reignited in the early 1900s, it was forgotten about for 20 years, reignited in the early 1900s. And by the time of his death in 1927, it had become firmly established that any contest on the cricket field between England and Australia was about the ashes. Ivo suddenly realised that this memento that he had was an important historical artefact from a cricketing point of view, and that's why after his death it was presented by his widow to MCC, and why it's continued to be a significant artefact, probably the most significant artefact we have in our collection to this very day. And it's strange to remember that when you consider how closely associated the idea of the urn is with the ashes these days, they're completely inseparable. To think back to the early years and realise that for 20 years after Ivo's tour, the ashes were completely forgotten about. Nobody talked about them. There's not a single mention in Wisden. And even after, in 1903-04, Pelham Warner's team won back the ashes, and he called his book on the tour How We Recovered the Ashes, which was how the legend reignited again. It wasn't really until the urn started being displayed at Lord's that the public imagination was captured by the image of the urn. From that point on, after it comes to Lord's, you start to see books about the ashes featuring sometimes the silhouette of the urn on the front cover, particularly when they were written by Pelham Warner. But it's gradually grown over the decades since, to a point where it's unimaginable now that we would ever separate the image of the urn from the idea of ashes cricket. But it's always been a symbol rather than an actual trophy.
Many thanks to Neil. He'll be back next week in the episode where we'll talk about some of the more unusual items in the MCC Museum, items with a connection to Glamorgan County Cricket Club, some of the writers and books that have been researched using the MCC Library, and an oral history project that had its origins in Wales and have deeply affected the work of the museum at Lord's. So do join us again when we'll be hearing some stories about the great game of cricket and the great country of Wales. Hoel fawr, bye for now.
Oes gyda chi stori i'w rhannu gyda ni? Mae croeso i chi gysylltu. E-bostiwch mwcpod1921@gmail.com neu ewch i'n tudalen Facebook, Museum of Welsh Cricket Podcast, neu i'n tudalen Twitter, @WelshCricketPod. Do you have a story you'd like to share with us? If so, please contact email mwcpod1921@gmail.com or go to our Facebook page, Museum of Welsh Cricket Podcast, or our Twitter, @WelshCricketPod.